BBC News.
You're listening to BBC Radio 4, and now, a courtesan's memoirs form our new classic serial.
We present Nancy Carroll in Publish and Be Damned, the memoirs of Harriet Wilson, written by herself and dramatised by Ellen Dryden. Episode 1.
I shall not say why and how I became, at the age of 15, the mistress of the Earl of Craven. Whether it was love, or the severity of my father, the depravity of my own heart, or the winning arts of the noble lord which induced me to leave my paternal roof and place myself under his protection, does not now much signify, or if it does, I'm not in the humour to gratify curiosity in this matter. I resided on the Marine Parade at Brighton, and I remember that Lord Craven used to draw cocoa trees and his fellows, as he called them, on the best vellum paper for my amusement. It was, in fact, a dead boar. In short, I soon found that I had made a bad speculation by going from my father to Lord Craven. I was even more afraid of the latter than I had been of the former. I was not depraved enough to determine immediately on a new choice, and yet I often thought about it. How indeed could I do otherwise when the Honourable Frederick Lamb was my constant visitor and talked to me of nothing else? I firmly believe that Frederick Lamb sincerely loved me, and deeply regretted that he had no fortune to invite me to share with him. Lord Melbourne, his father, was a good man. Not one of your stiff-laced, moralising fathers who preach chastity and forbearance to their children. Quite the contrary. He congratulated his son on the lucky circumstance of his friend Craven having such a fine girl with him.
No such thing. I'm unsuccessful there. Harriet will have nothing at all to do with me.
Nonsense. I never heard anything half so ridiculous in all my life. The girl must be mad. She looks mad. I thought so the other day when I met her galloping about, with her feathers blowing and her thick dark hair about her ears. I'll speak to Harriet for you. Not have my son, indeed. 6 feet high. A fine, straight, handsome, noble young fellow. I wonder what you would have.
In truth, I scarcely knew myself. But something I determined on, so miserably tired was I of Craven and his cocoa trees and his sailing boats and his ugly cotton nightcap. Surely all men do not wear those shocking nightcaps, else all women's illusions have been destroyed on the first night of their marriage. Crossing the Steyne as I took my morning walk, I encountered Lord Melbourne.
Where's Craven?
Attending to his military duties at Lewes, my lord.
Where's my son, Fred?
I am not your son's keeper, my lord.
What the devil can you possibly have to say against my son, Fred?
Good heavens, my lord, you frighten me. I have never said a single word against your son as long as I have lived. Why should I?
Why indeed? And since there is nothing to be said against him, what excuse can you make for using him so ill?
I don't understand you one bit, my lord.
Did you not turn the poor boy out of your house as soon as it was dark? Although Craven was in London and there was not the shadow of an excuse for such treatment?
At this moment, and before I could recover from my surprise at the tenderness of some parents, Frederick Lamb, who was almost my shadow, suddenly appeared.
Ah, Fred, my boy. I'll leave you two together. Good day, ma'am.
Harriet, I must join my regiment in Yorkshire soon. God knows when we may meet again. I'm sure you will not long continue with Lord Craven. I foresee what will happen, and yet until it does, I think I shall go mad. I beg you, allow me to introduce my brother William to you.
What for?
So that he may let me know how you behave.
And if I fall in love with him?
I'm sure you won't. Not because he is not likeable. On the contrary, William is much handsomer than I am, but he will not love you as I do, and you are too good to forget me entirely.
For my part, I felt flattered and obliged by the affection Frederick Lamb evinced towards me, but I was still not in love with him. At length, the time arrived when he could delay his departure from Brighton no longer. Our parting scene was rather tender. For the last 10 days, Lord Craven being absent, we had scarcely been separated an hour during the whole day, and Frederick Lamb really respected me for the perseverance with which I had resisted his urgent wishes when he would have had me deceive Lord Craven. 2 days after his departure for Hull in Yorkshire, Lord Craven returned to Brighton, and his servant brought me the following letter. A friend of mine has informed me of what has been going on at Brighton. This information, added to what I have seen with my own eyes of your intimacy with Frederick Lamb, obliges me to declare that we must separate. Let me add, Harriet, that you might have done anything with me, with only a little more conduct. As it is, allow me to wish you happy, and further, pray inform me if in any way, from a distance, I can promote your welfare. Craven. Ha! This letter completed my dislike of Lord Craven. I never wronged this man. I hate his fine carriage and his money. And I shall hate Coco as long as I live. The next morning, while I was considering what was to become of me, I received a very affectionate letter from Frederick Lamb, dated Hull. He dared not, he said, be selfish enough to ask me to share his poverty. My case was desperate, for I had taken a vow not to remain another night under Lord Craven's roof. John, therefore, the footman whom Craven had, I suppose, imported with his cocoa trees from the West Indies, was desired to secure me a place in the mail for Hull. We continued here for about 3 months and then came to London. Fred Lamb's passion increased daily, but I discovered on our arrival in London that he was a voluptuary, both worldly and selfish. I lived in extreme poverty, while he contrived to enjoy all the luxuries of life. I felt that I deserved better from him.
Frederick, is the Marquis of Lorne as handsome as they say?
The finest fellow on earth. All the women adore him.
And then he went on to relate various anecdotes of his lordship, which strongly excited my curiosity. Soon after this, he quitted town for a few weeks, and I was left alone in London without money, or at any rate with very little, and Frederick Lamb cared not a jot for my distresses. In a fit of anger, I wrote to the Marquis of Lorne, merely to say that if he would walk up to Duke's Row, Somers Town, he would meet a most lovely girl. This was his answer.
If you are but half as lovely as you think yourself, you must be well worth knowing. But how is that to be managed? Not in the street, but come to number 39 Portland Street and ask for me. Lorne.
My reply was this. No. Our first meeting must be on the high road, in order that I may have room to run away, in case I don't like you. Harriet.
Well then, fair lady, tomorrow at 4 near the turnpike, look for me on horseback. And then, you know, I can gallop away. Lorne.
We met. The Duke of Argyll, he has since succeeded to the title, did not gallop away, and for my part, I had never seen a countenance I had thought half so beautifully expressive. We walked together for about 2 hours.
I never saw such a sunny, happy countenance as yours in my whole life.
Oh, but I am happier than usual today.
Well, then, do me the honour someday to come and dine or sup with me at Argyll House.
I shall not be able to run away if I go there.
Shall you want to run away from me when we know each other better? Will you walk again with me tomorrow?
I assented, and we parted. I returned to my home in unusual spirits. They were a little damped, however, by the reflection that I had been doing wrong. I cannot, I fear, become what the world calls a steady, prudent, virtuous woman, but I will never become vile. My dear mother would never forgive me if I became artful. When I am ill-used, I will leave my lover rather than deceive him. Frederick Lamb relies in perfect confidence on my honour. I must tell him tonight, as soon as he arrives from the country, that I have written to and walked with Lorne. To my joy and astonishment, Frederick Lamb was not a bit angry. I must not deceive this man, I thought, and the idea began to make me a little melancholy. The next morning, with my heart beating unusually high, I attended my appointment with Argyll. I hoped, almost expected, to find him there before me. I paraded near the turnpike for 5 minutes, then grew angry. In 5 more, I became wretched. In 5 more, downright indignant. And in 5 more, wretched again. And so I returned home. This shall be a lesson to me, never to go to meet a man. It is unnatural. Suddenly, I flew to my writing desk and wrote to His Grace as follows. It was very wrong and very bold of me to have sought your acquaintance in the way I did, my lord, and I entreat you to forgive and forget my childish folly. I have not deserved this contempt from you, and so I take my leave. Not in anger, my lord, but with the steady determination so to profit by the humiliating lesson you have given me as never to expose myself to such contempt again. Your most obedient servant, Harriet Wilson. Having put my letter in the post, I passed a restless night, and the next morning heard the knock of a tuppenny postman in extreme agitation.
You are not half vain enough, dear Harriet. You ought to have been quite certain that any man who had once met you could not fail in a second appointment but from unavoidable accident. And if you're only half as pleased with Thursday morning as I was, you will meet me tomorrow in the same place at 4. Pray, pray come. Lorne.
It shall be his turn now. The hour of Argyle's appointment arrived and passed without my leaving my house. The next day I was surprised by a visit from Tom Sheridan, only son of Richard Brinsley Sheridan, the playwright. I had, by mere accident, become acquainted with that very interesting young man when quite a child.
I'm come from my friend, Lorne. The poor fellow is really annoyed, and he has commissioned me to acquaint you with the accident which obliged him to break his appointment, because I can best vouch for the truth of it, having, with my own ears, heard the Prince of Wales invite Lord Lorne to Carlton House at the very moment when he was about to meet you in Somerstown. He desires me to say that he is not coxcomb enough to imagine you cared for him, but it is very hard to lose the goodwill of one of the nicest, cleverest girls he ever met with in his life by such a mere accident. Therefore, you'll make it up with him, won't you?
There is nothing to forgive, if no slight was meant. I would have been less indignant, but that I fancied his grace neglected me because...
Because what?
Nothing.
What a pretty girl you are, particularly when you blush.
Fiddlesticks. You know you always preferred my sister Fanny.
Well, there I plead guilty. Fanny is the sweetest creature on earth. But you're all a race of finished coquettes who delight in making fools of people.
I was never vain in your society in my life.
I would give the world for a kiss at this moment, because you look so humble and so amiable. But this is not exactly the embassy I came upon. Have you a mind to give Lorne an agreeable surprise?
I don't know.
Upon my honour, I believe he is downright in love with you.
Well?
Come into a hackney coach with me, and we will drive down to the tennis court in the Haymarket.
Is the Duke there?
Yes.
But at all events, I will not trust myself in a hackney coach with you.
There was a time. There was a time. But now you may drive with me from here to St. Paul's in the most perfect safety. I'll tell you a secret. I'm dying. But nobody knows it yet.
My dear Mr. Sheridan, you have accused me of being vain of the little beauty God has given me. Now I would give it all to obtain the certainty that you would refrain from such excesses as are destroying you.
Did you see me play the Methodist parson in a tub at Mrs. Beaumont's masquerade last Thursday?
You may laugh at a little fool like me pretending to preach to you, yet I am sensible enough to admire you and quite feeling enough to regret your time so misspent, your brilliant talent so misapplied.
Bravo. What a funny little girl you are. Pray, miss, how is your time spent?
Not in drinking brandy.
My good little girl, it's in the blood, and I can't help it, and if I could, it's too late now. I'm dying, I tell you. I don't know if my poor father's physician was as eloquent as you are, but he did his best to turn him from drinking. Among other things, he declared to him one day that the brandy, arquebusade and eau de cologne he swallowed would burn off the coat of his stomach. Then, said my father, my stomach must digest in its waistcoat, for I cannot help it.
Indeed, I am very sorry for you, and I hope he believed me, for he pressed my hand hastily, and I think I saw a tear glisten in his bright, dark eye.
Shall I tell Lorne that you will write to him, or will you come to the tennis court?
Neither. But you may tell his lordship that I am not angry.
Nothing more?
Nothing for his lordship.
And what for me?
You? What do you want?
The kiss?
Not I, indeed.
Be it so, then. And yet, you and I may never meet again on this earth, and just now I thought you felt some interest about me.
So I do, dear Tom Sheridan. You know I have a very warm and feeling heart and taste enough to admire and like you. But why is this to be our last meeting?
I must go to the Mediterranean.
God bless you. I kissed his hand, and then, though somewhat timidly,
leaned my face towards him. He parted my hair and kissed my forehead, my eyes and my lips.
If I do come back, mind, let me find you married and rich enough to lend me an occasional £100 or two.
He then kissed his hand gracefully and was out of sight in an instant. I never saw him again.
The next morning, my maid brought me a little note from Argyle to say that he had been waiting about my door an hour, having learned my address from poor Sheridan. I looked out of the window, saw Argyle, ran for my hat and cloak and joined him in an instant.
Am I forgiven?
Oh, yes. Long ago. But that will do you no good. For I really am treating Frederick Lamb very ill. I must not walk with you again. I could never deceive any man. I have told him the whole story of our becoming acquainted, and he allows me to walk with you. It is I who think it wrong, not Frederick.
That is to say, you think me a bore.
And suppose I loved you. I am engaged to Frederick Lamb, who trusts me.
If it were possible you did love me, Frederick Lamb would be forgotten, but though you don't love me, you must try and do so someday or other. You don't know how much I've fixed my heart on it.
There was a very elegant-looking woman residing in my neighbourhood, in a beautiful little cottage, who had long excited my curiosity. She appeared to be the mother of five extremely beautiful children, and seemed to live in complete retirement. One day she smiled and wished me a good morning. We soon got into conversation.
You are the first female I have spoken to for 4 years, with the exception of my own servants. But someday we may know each other better. In the meantime, will you trust yourself to come and dine with me today?
With great pleasure, if you think me worthy that honour. When I entered her drawing room at the hour she had appointed, I was struck with the elegant taste more than with the richness of the furniture. A beautiful harp, drawings of a somewhat voluptuous cast, and a fine pianoforte formed part of it. She is not a bad woman, and she is not a good woman, said I to myself. What can she be?
I am not quite sure whether I can have the pleasure of introducing you to Mr. Johnston today or not. We will not wait dinner for him if he does not arrive in time.
This was the first word I had heard about a Mr. Johnston, although I knew the lady was called by that name. Just as we were sitting down to dinner, Mr. Johnston arrived and was introduced to me. He was a particularly elegant, handsome man, about 40 years of age. His manner of addressing Mrs. Johnston was more that of a humble romantic lover than of a husband. I could not endure all this mystery. And when he left us in the evening, I frankly asked Julia, for so we will call her in the future, why she invited a strange madcap girl like me to dinner with her.
Consider the melancholy life I lead.
Thank you for the compliment.
But do you believe that I should have asked you to dine with me if I had not been particularly struck and pleased with you? I had, as I passed your window, heard you touch the pianoforte with a very masterly hand, and therefore I conceived that you were not uneducated, and I knew that you led almost as retired a life as myself. Some day, perhaps soon, you shall know all about me.
There was something dramatic about Julia. I often surprised her, hanging over her harp so very gracefully, the room so perfumed that it appeared arranged for the purpose, like a scene in a play. I will not say in what particular year of his life the Duke of Argyle succeeded with me. Ladies scorn dates. Dates make ladies nervous and stories dry. It was at that critical period of his life, when his whole and sole possessions appeared to consist in 36 of ragged lawn shirts, a threadbare suit of snuff colour, a little old hat with very little binding left, an old horse, an old groom, an old carriage and an old chateau. It was to console himself for all his antiquity, I suppose, that he fixed upon so very young a mistress as myself. Thus, after having gone through all the routine of sighs, vows and rural walks, he at last saw me blooming and safe in his dismal chateau in Argyle Street.
A late hour in the morning blushed to find us in each other's arms. The morning was pale compared with the red on my cheek when I acquainted Fred Lamb with my adventure. He was half choked with rage and pride. I immediately changed my lodgings for a furnished house at the west end of town, better calculated to receive my new lover, whose passion knew no bounds. He often told me how much more beautiful I was than he had ever expected to find. I fancied he was alluding to his old flame, Lady W., with whom the world said he had been intriguing for 19 years. I could not bear the idea that all the tenderness and passion he seemed to feel for me was shared between myself and Lady W.
I shall go home now.
Go home? My dear little Harriet, you're walking in your sleep.
I am not asleep, but I will not stay here. I cannot. I would rather die.
Oh, my dear, dear Harriet, for God's sake, tell me, what on earth have I done to offend you?
Nothing. Nothing. I have but one favour to ask. Let me alone, instead of persecuting me with all this show of tenderness.
Oh, gracious God, how you torment me! If you have ceased to love me, if you are disgusted...
No, no!
By heavens, you shall not torture me so another moment!
He's going to kill me. No, no, I am not tired of you. Dear Lorn, forgive me. Forgive me. Forgive me.
Our reconciliation was completed in the usual way.
The next morning, I was greatly surprised by a visit from my dear, lively sister Fanny on her arrival from the country. Fanny was the most popular woman I ever met with. The most ill-natured and spiteful of her sex could never find it in their hearts to abuse her. She was the most beautiful of our family. She had led a most retired, steady life for 7 years, and was the mother of 3 children at the death of their father, Mr. Woodcock, to whom Fanny would have been married could he have obtained a divorce from his wife. Fanny and our new acquaintance, Julia, soon became sworn friends.
Now, Harriet and I propose cutting you, Mrs. Julia, altogether if you do not this very evening give us a full and true account of yourself. From the day you were born, and the date thereof, up to this hour.
No dates, Fanny, no dates, I pray.
Well, waive dates and begin.
My mother is Lord Carrisford's sister. She was one of the maids of honour to Queen Caroline. I was educated in France at first, and then at the Palace of Hampton Court. It was while I was there, my mother sent me on a visit to the wife of Colonel Cotton, an officer in the 10th Dragoons. Mrs. Cotton had a family of 9 children and very little fortune to support them. And, oh, Colonel Cotton.
The first night Colonel Cotton danced with her, she was mad. In 4 months more, she was pregnant. In 9 months more, having concealed her situation, she was seized with the pangs of labour while in the act of paying her respects to Her Majesty at court.
My sufferings were short, but dreadfully severe. In about 5 hours, unassisted, I became the mother of a fine boy. My family hurried me away into the country with my baby, almost at the risk of my life. I shall not attempt to describe the rage and fury of my mother. She loaded me with abuse. My beloved Colonel Cotton was called out by my own brother and wounded. I contrived to write to my dearest to declare that if we were to meet no more, I would immediately destroy myself.
In short, Julia was wild for Cotton, and Cotton was raving mad for Julia. He hired a very retired cottage near town. Julia, who had inherited a small fortune over which her parents had no control, supported herself there for more than 8 years. I never saw such romantic people. After 9 years and 5 children... At the opera, I learned to be a complete flirt. For there I saw Argyle incessantly with Lady W, and it became incumbent on me either to laugh or cry. My eldest sister Amy's box was close to ours, and almost as soon as we were seated she entered, dressed in the foreign style, which became her, accompanied by Counts Voronzoff,
Beckendorf and Orloff. Most people believe that Fanny, Julia and I were sisters, and called us the Three Graces. It was a pity that there were only three Graces. Amy was cut out of this ring and often named one of the Furies. Why she hated me all her life, I cannot conceive. It was Amy who had been the first to set us a bad example. We were all virtuous girls when Amy, one fine afternoon, left our father's house and sallied forth like Don Quixote in quest of adventures. Amy's virtue was something like the nine lives of a cat. She lived in York Place, where she used to give gay evening parties to half the fashionable men in town after the opera. My box was soon so crowded that I was obliged to turn one out as fast as a new face appeared. Fanny left me to pay a visit to Amy. Lord Ulvenley now entered my box.
How's this? A vacancy for two? You'll lose your character, Harriet.
You sup with Amy, I hope.
Yes. I wish you would send some of those dirty Russians away.
She has got a little Portuguese besides the Russians coming to her tonight. The Count Parmela, the ambassador.
Oh, God bless my soul.
They're only all brought up on trial. She will cut the rest as soon as she has fixed on one of them.
Yes, but you see, we have no chance after these Cossacks. Oh, there is Argyle looking at you. From Lady W's box, Harriet.
This remark put me out of humour. Although I did observe, though he sat in her ladyship's box, he was thinking of me. There was all the world at Amy's, and not half room enough for them. Some were in the passage, and some in the parlour, and in the drawing room one could scarcely breathe. At the top of it, Amy sat coquetting with her tall Russians. The poor Count Palmella stood gazing on her at a humble distance. The little delicate, gentleman-like Portuguese was no match for these Cossacks. I do not believe he got a single word in the whole evening.
Tomorrow evening, I shall go to see the tragedy of Romeo and Juliet.
What tragedy is that, pray?
You may laugh at me as much as you please, and I must have patience and bear it, I to wrong, for I cannot pronounce the letter R.
Oh, how very odd. Why, you could pronounce it well enough at home.
I really did not mean to tease her. I thought perhaps lisping might grow on us as we got older, but I soon guessed it was all a sham, the struggle between the wish to show off her feminine softness to her lovers and the desire to knock me down.
Harriet, I'm sorry to say, may be correct.
Who, pray, was your man of this morning, Fanny?
You allude to the gentleman I was riding with in the park, Lord Alden.
I know who he is. Fanny is a very nice girl, and I wish you would not encourage such people. Upon my word, it is quite shocking.
Whom did you ride with today, Fanny?
The damn sugar baker.
I rode out today with a very respectable man of large fortune.
Oh, yes. There's a good deal of money to be got in the sugar line.
What is his name?
Mr. John Mitchell. He received his education at a certain public school with Lord Ulvenley.
I do not recollect Mitchell, but I believe there were a good many grocers admitted at that time.
Now, gentlemen, have the goodness to listen to the facts as they really are. That little fat gentleman there, Lord Ulvenley. I have been led to understand that being much lower down in the class than Mitchell, though of the same age, his lordship, in the year 1800 and something or other, was selected to the situation of prime and first fag to Mr. Mitchell. In which said department, his lordship distinguished himself by the very high polish he put upon Mr. J. Mitchell's boots and shoes.
There was not a word of truth in this story, the mere creation of Fanny's brain. Yet still there was a probability about it, as they had been at school together, and Fanny's very pleasing expression set the whole room in a roar of laughter.
What a squeeze! We really are too full here.
I'm going for one, Amy.
To Argyle House, I suppose. You will be Duchess of Argyle, Harriet.
I found Argyle at his door with his key. A little impatient.
Why did you not go to Amy's?
I don't know your sister Amy, and I dislike what I have seen of her. She makes so many advances to me.
I defended my sister as warmly as though she had really treated me with kindness, and felt at the time seriously angry with the Duke for abusing her. The season for Argyle's departure from London for the North was now drawing very near. He often spoke of it with regret, and sometimes he talked about my accompanying him. Lorne had fascinated me and was the first man for whom I had felt the least passion. But his age made him fitter to be my father than my friend and companion. And then this Lady W. How could I fix my affections on a man whom I knew to be attached still to another woman? I was getting into debt, as well as my sister Amy, when it so came to pass, as I have since heard say, that the immortal... No, that's common. Terrific, that will do better. The terrific Duke of Wellington, the wonder of the world, who, feeling himself amorously inclined one sultry evening, ordered his coachman to set him down at the White Horse Cellar in Piccadilly, whence he sallied forth on foot to Berkeley Street and rapped hastily at the door, which was immediately opened by the tawdry, well-rouged housekeeper of Mrs. Porter, who, with a significant nod of recognition, led him into her mistress's boudoir, and then hurried away, simpering, to acquaint the good Mrs. Porter with the arrival of one of her oldest customers.
Is it not charming weather?
There is a beautiful girl just come out. Very fine creature. They call her Harriet. And,
My lord, I have had three applications this very month for the girl they call Harriet, and I have already introduced myself to her. She is the wildest creature I ever saw.
My good woman, my time is precious. 100 guineas are yours, and as much again Harriet's, if you can induce her to give me the meeting.
My dear lord, what would I not do to serve you? I will pay Harriet a visit early tomorrow morning.
Make haste about it. I shall call for your answer in 2 days. In the meantime, if you have anything like good news to communicate, address a line to Thomas's Hotel, Berkeley Square.
These two respectable friends now took leave of each other, as we will of the subject, for the moment at least. I rather think it must have been on the very day the above took place that Fanny and myself dined together at my house, and Amy, unasked, joined us after dinner because she had nothing better to do.
You are welcome, as long as you bring me no men. Men I will not admit, because I am not a coquette like you. And it fatigues me to death to be eternally making the agreeable to a set of men who might all be buried and nobody would miss them. Besides, I have seen such a man.
What manner of man have you seen?
A very god.
Who is he?
I do not know.
What is his name?
I cannot tell.
Where did you see him?
In Sloane Street, riding on horseback and followed by a large dog.
What a simpleton you are.
I never made myself so ridiculous about any man yet as you have. And what have you done with Palmella? Did you send the letter I wrote for you?
Yes.
And did he send you the £200?
Directly, with a letter full of professions of the deepest gratitude.
And where is that poor dear little man now?
God knows. I have been denied to him ever since. My dear Colonel Sydenham has been telling me that I am too beautiful, and it would really be too great a sacrifice for me to throw myself away on Palmella.
Did Sydenham also say that your returning the £200 would be too great a sacrifice?
No, but I have spent it.
It was now growing late, and we separated. The next morning my servant informed me that a lady desired to speak a word to me. Her name was Porter.
My dear wild young lady, I am come to inform you that you have made the conquest of a very fine, noble, unexceptionable man.
Delightful. Who is he?
I dare not tell you his name, but you may rest assured that he is a man of fashion and rank.
Oh, it will not do. Tell your friend that I have no money, that I do not know how to take care of myself, and Argyle takes no care of me. Tell him that nobody wants a real steady friend more than I do, but I cannot meet a stranger as a lover. Tell him all this, if he is really handsome, that is to say, and let me know ever what he says tomorrow.
Indeed I will, my dear young lady. I will take my leave and do so immediately.
The next morning I received another visit from Mrs. Porter.
I have just had an interview with your new admirer and reported to him all you had desired me to say. Since you object to meet a stranger, His Grace desires me to say he hopes you can keep a secret, and to inform you that it is the Duke of Wellington who so anxiously desires to make your acquaintance.
Oh, I have heard of His Grace often.
I had been indulging a kind of hope about the stranger with the great Newfoundland dog, whom I thought of every hour.
His Grace only entreats to be allowed to make your acquaintance His situation, you know, prevents the possibility of his getting regularly introduced to you.
It will never do.
Be assured he is a remarkably fine-looking man. And if you are afraid of my house, promise to receive him in your own. At any hour when he may be certain to find you alone.
Well, I suppose he must come. I do not understand economy and am frightened to death of debts. And I shall want a steady sort of friend in case a bailiff should get hold of me.
What shall I say to His Grace?
Well then, since it must be so, tell His Grace that I will receive him tomorrow at 3:00. But mind, only as a common acquaintance. A way-winged Wellington's Mercury. And most punctual to my appointment at 3:00 on the following day, Wellington made his appearance.
How do you do? Thank you for permission to call on you.
Really, for such a renowned hero, you have very little to say for yourself.
Beautiful creature. Where is Lorne?
Good gracious! What come you here for, Duke?
Beautiful eyes, yours.
Aye, man. They are greater conquerors than ever Wellington shall be. But to be serious, I understood you came here to try to make yourself agreeable?
So, you think I have nothing better to do than to make speeches to please ladies?
Having depopulated the earth, you should make some effort to repeople it.
You should see me where I shine.
And where's that, in God's name?
In a field of battle.
Do you know, the world talks about hanging you.
Eh?
They say you will be hanged, in spite of all your brother Wellesley can say in your defence.
What paper do you read?
It is the common talk of the day.
They must not work me so hard in such another campaign, or my weight will never hang me.
Why, you look a little like the apothecary in Romeo already. But love scenes, or even love quarrels, seldom tend to amuse the reader, so to be brief, Wellington was now my constant visitor. A most unentertaining one, heaven knows. And in the evenings, when he wore his broad red ribbon, he looked very like a rat catcher.
I now walked oftener than usual. Indeed, whenever I could make anybody walk with me, because I wanted to meet the man with his Newfoundland dog, who was not the sort of man either that generally strikes the fancy of a very young female, for he was neither young nor at all gaily dressed. I had of late frequently met him, and he always turned his head back after he had passed me. But whether he admired or observed me, or whether he only looked back after his dog, was what puzzled and tormented me. One day, just as I was going to sit down to dinner with Fanny and Amy, I felt a kind of presentiment come over me that if I went into Hyde Park at that moment, I should meet this stranger. It was past 6:00. I had never seen him but at that hour. They both declared that I was mad, and Lord Alvanley, calling on Fanny at that moment, they retailed my folly to his lordship.
I dare say it's some dog fancier or whipper-in or something of that sort. God bless my soul, I thought you had more sense.
How rude you all are. I have told you frequently that this is my dinner hour and you never attend to it.
It is those damned grocers, the Mitchells, who've taught you to dine at this hour. Who the devil dines at 6:00? Why, I'm only just out of bed.
Alvanley accompanied me as far as Hyde Park, laughing at me and my man and his dog all the way. The park was now entirely empty. Nothing like a hero, nor even a dog, to be seen.
I must now wish you farewell. I am not going to be groom.
I shook hands with him, without at all understanding what he meant, and walked down towards that side of the river where I had once or twice seen the stranger coaxing his dog to swim by throwing stones into the water. If I could but once see him walking with any man I had ever met before, then at least I should have the chance of learning his name. I continued to wander up and down the river for nearly an hour. As I was returning home, disappointed as usual, I met an elderly gentleman, whose name I forget, though we had often seen each other in society. He stopped to converse with me on common subjects for a few minutes, and just as he had taken his leave and was slowly walking his horse away, a very clean, aged woman came up to me.
My dear young lady, can you spare a coin for a poor old woman?
Her manners were unlike those of a common beggar. She smiled on me and looked as if she would have been as much pleased by a few kind words as with money. I always liked very old people when they were clean and appeared respectable, and I eagerly searched my reticule.
Alas, I cannot help you. My purse is empty.
Oh, never mind, my dear young lady. Many a blessed God a more in want than I am.
Oh, wait here a minute. I ran as fast as I possibly could after the old gentleman who was fast disappearing. Sir?
Yes?
Pray forgive my impertinence in asking your assistance. I have been so foolish as to forget my purse. And now I have occasion for half a crown, which I hope you will lend me.
Oh, certainly, with pleasure.
Oh, thank you, sir. Please accept my apologies.
Turning hastily towards some trees which led by a rather shorter road to where I had left the old woman, I came immediately in close contact with the stranger, whose person had been concealed by two large elms, and who might have been observing me for some time. After passing days and days in looking for him, his sudden appearance caused such a tremulousness to come over me that I lacked the courage to raise my eyes to his face. So I felt, rather than knew, I was near him. I passed by him as quickly as my extreme agitation would permit, and soon came up with the old woman.
My good woman, here is half a crown.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, my dear sweet young lady. It hasn't always been like this with me. I kept a respectable inn for 30 years in Glasgow.
Which, from her language, I was inclined to believe.
Thank you, my dear sweet young lady, thank you. Thank you.
I now ventured to turn my head back, believing myself at a safe distance from the stranger. He had quitted his hiding place and was slowly walking his very fine horse towards me. I thought our eyes met and that the stranger blushed, but his was so immediately withdrawn from my face that I went home, still in doubt whether he had taken sufficient notice of me, even to know me again by sight. By a little before 8 on the following evening, we were all off to the opera. We found Julia in our private box, alone and half asleep, dressed very elegantly and, in my opinion, looking very interesting and well. Julia had lately got nearly to the bottom of her heroics with Cotton. She was ashamed to admit the idea even to herself, but the fact was she was tired of Cotton and longing secretly for something new. He had not a shilling to spare for the support of Julia's children, and Julia's accouchement took place regularly every 11 months.
Do, my dear Julia, consider all your beautiful children. And if you can leave Cotton to his poor wife and must form another connection, let it be with someone who can contribute to the support of your young family.
I assure you, at this moment, I am actually expecting to be arrested for debt. Fanny, if they do come for me, will you please go to my noble relations and entreat them to help me?
I promise you, dear Julia, I will.
Thank you.
Fanny then related all about my last meeting with my stranger and his dog to Julia, who seemed to understand my sensations much better than Fanny did.
Oh, mon Dieu. In that box, next to Lady Foley's, a man even handsomer than my stranger. It is he.
Where?
Oh, that someone would come into our box now and tell us who he is.
How provoking you are. Why don't you point the man out to us?
It is that man who is laughing. Oh, I had no idea his teeth were so very beautiful.
Dear me, how tiresome. If you will not tell us which is your man, let us talk of something else.
He is there, next to Lady Foley's box, leaning on his arm.
Where's my eyeglass? I can see nothing without it. I know him.
How well? Did you ever speak to him?
I met him in society when I was a girl, but I was a close friend with a girl to whom he proposed. Her wedding clothes were made. She used to sleep in my room with his picture round her neck. She adored him beyond all that could be imagined of love and devotion, and within a few days of their proposed marriage, he declared off. His excuse was that his father refused his consent. For many years, my friend's parents trembled for her reason. No one was permitted to name her former lover in her presence. She's now Lady Cunningham.
And his name?
Lord Ponsonby. He is supposed to be the handsomest man in England, but he must now be 40, if not more.
I wish he were 60. As it is, I have no chance. I never thought I had. He is the sort of man I think I could be wicked enough to say my prayers to.
could wait for hours near his house for the chance of seeing him pass or hearing his voice.
Well done, Harriet. You are more romantic than I was at your age, and I thought that was impossible.
And you did not love Lord Ponsonby?
True, Ponsonby is very near perfection. But what chance can you have? He's married to the loveliest creature on earth, the youngest daughter of Lord Jersey.
I knew very well before I heard of his marriage that I should never be anything to him.
I will tell you where he lives. It is in Curzon Street, Mayfair.
Well then, at least when he passes me, I shall not, as yesterday, fancy I'm looking at him for the last time. Which is his wife?
I cannot find her box, else I should know her immediately.
We now lost sight of his lordship for some time, he having left the box I first saw him in. I perceived him for an instant afterwards, but missed him altogether before the opera was over. I am glad I have not seen his wife. I hope I shall never see her as long as I live.
I resolved now to make no kind of advances to become acquainted with Lord Ponsonby. But on the very next evening, I indulged myself in passing his house at least 50 times. Even the knocker of his door did not escape my veneration, since Lord Ponsonby must have touched it so often. Suppose he were to love me. The idea caused my heart to beat wildly. It was ridiculous. What was I that Lord Ponsonby should think about me? Still, there was no reason why I might not love Lord Ponsonby. I was made for love, and I look for no return. I was young, and my wishes had hitherto rarely been suppressed by disappointment. Wellington called on me the next morning before I had finished my breakfast. I tried him on every subject I could muster. On all, he was most impenetrably taciturn. At last, he started an original idea of his own actual copyright.
I wonder you do not get married, Harriet.
Why so? By the by, ignorant people are always wondering.
Wellington, however, gives no reason for anything unconnected with fighting, and he therefore again became silent. Then another burst of Attic sentiment blazed forth.
I was thinking of you last night, after I got into bed.
How very polite to the Duchess. Apropos to marriage, Duke, how do you like it?
I was thinking that you will get into some scrape when I go to Spain.
Nothing so serious as marriage, I hope.
I must come again tomorrow to give you a little advice.
Oh, let us have it all out now and have done with it.
I cannot. No time.
I'm glad he is off. This was very uphill work indeed. It is worse than Lord Craven. The tough qualities which obtained Wellington such renown in the field of battle possessed no merit at all for home service or ladies' use. And pray, madam, the reader may ask, how came you to be such a monster as to call this kind, generous-hearted man a bore? I do not know, I am sure, and really am very sorry for it now. But then the book will never be finished, if I am to stop and make corrections and alterations. Moreover, Stockdale, my dear publisher, has run away with that part of the manuscript. Some short time after, Wellington took himself again to the wars, and called to take a hasty leave of me a few hours before his departure.
I am off for Spain directly.
I know not how it was, but I grew melancholy. I saw him there, perhaps for the last time in my life. Oh, God! God bless you, Wellington! His astonishment at my tears seemed to me not quite unmixed with gratitude. He kissed my cheek.
If you change your home, let me find your address at Thomas's Hotel as soon as I come to England. And if you want anything in the meantime, write to Spain.
No.
Do not cry. Take care of yourself. And do not cut me dead when I come back. Do you hear?
He wiped away some of my tears with my handkerchief, and kissed my eyes.
God bless you.
More than a month had now elapsed since Lord Ponsonby left London, and I perceived no signs of his return. Yet I never forgot him. One evening, when Fanny and Julia dined with me, I got up from my table to open my window, and I saw Lord Ponsonby, who was slowly riding by my house with his face turned towards my window. This time, there could be no doubt as to his blushing. My happiness was now of a nature too pure to be trifled with. I could not sleep a wink all night. At 9 the next morning, my maid entered the room with a letter, which had just arrived by the tuppenny post. It was as follows.
I have long been very desirous to make your acquaintance. Will you let me? A friend of mine has told me about you, but I am afraid that you were only laughing at me. I hope, at all events, that you will write me one line to say you forgive me and direct it to my house in town. P.
I will not attempt to describe all I felt on the receipt of this first epistle from Lord Ponsonby. I am now astonished at that infatuation which could render a girl like me, possessed certainly of a very affectionate heart, thus thoughtless and careless of the fate of another. But I declare to my reader that Lady Fanny Ponsonby never once entered my head. This was my answer to Lord Ponsonby's letter. For the last 5 months I have scarcely lived but in your sight, and everything I have done or wished or hoped or thought about has had reference to you and your happiness. Now tell me what you wish, Harriet.
I fancy, though we never met, that you and I are in fact acquainted and understand each other perfectly. And when I tell you that we cannot meet immediately, owing to a very severe domestic calamity, you will not say I am cold. In the meantime, will you write to me? The little watch I've got for you, I am not quite satisfied with. I've seen one in better taste. But my poor father is dying and counts the minutes of my absence. Or I could have found one to please you. However, you will keep this one for my sake. I will leave it myself at your house this evening. I can scarcely describe to you how exhausted I am, for I have passed the whole of the 3 last nights by the bedside of my sick father. I know he will have your prayers. At midnight, let us pray for him together. He's been suffering more than 5 months. Adieu, dear Harriet.
Ponsonby was now mine. Mine by right.
My beloved, my spirits and health fail me. They are worn out and exhausted with this close confinement. My poor father no longer suffers or is scarcely sensible. My brother George will take my place by his bedside. Let us meet this evening, and you will console me. I shall go to you at 9.
Lord Ponsonby was then coming to me at last. I began to think I was dreaming and that he was not coming.
Oh. No, my dear little Harriet, let us be happy. Now we are met.
We conversed together all night, with my head resting on his shoulder. Ponsonby's health and spirits were evidently quite exhausted by anxiety and want of rest. Neither of us desired anything while we thus engaged in conversation.
No, not tonight. I could not bear your kiss tonight. We will dream about it till tomorrow. From the first time I saw you 2 years ago in Somerstown, I could think of nothing else for days after that. Then I saw you with Argyle and tried to forget you. But though you didn't see me, I was always looking at you. When I saw you in the park, there was something so natural and unaffected and wild about your manner that I began to forget your notoriety.
Ponsonby then told me all about the poor old woman to whom I had given 0.5 crown in the park. But what he said was far too flattering for me to repeat. It was past 5 in the morning when we separated. We made no professions of love to each other, not one, for we were certain that we adored each other. And yet we passed the night together and parted without a kiss, to meet early the following evening. Heavy work, ma'am, all this love and stuff, says my fair reader of 60, taking off her spectacles. And my young reader does not like playing second fiddle, which is my own reason for hating novels.
At 9 o'clock the following evening, Ponsonby entered the room, an altered man. He was one of the very few persons I have met with who, from natural reserve and shyness, absolutely required to be a very little tipsy before they can give their brilliant imaginations fair play. Ponsonby had slept, drunk a little more claret, and what lately had been unusual to him owing to his father's lingering illness, had put on an evening dress. He appeared now so much more beautiful than I had ever imagined that I began to lose my confidence in myself and tremble.
You are so proud of being dressed tonight.
The fact is, I really am proud of it. I've not worn these shoes for these last 3 months. But you know what I'm most proud of? In the world, and which, poor as I am, I would not exchange at this moment for £100,000.
No.
I'll tell you. My place in your heart and your arms this evening.
He put his arms round my waist, and my lips were nearly touching his. Yet he turned from my kiss like a spoiled child.
No, I have 1,000 things to tell you.
I cannot listen to one of them. And our lips met in one long, long, delicious kiss. So sweet, so ardent. And then, yes, and then we parted.
In episode 1 of Publish and Be Damned, the memoirs of Harriet Wilson, written by herself, Nancy Carroll played Harriet. Blake Ritson was Argyle, Barnaby K. Wellington, and Charles Edwards, Lord Ponsonby and Lord Melbourne. Fanny was Anna Francolini, Julia, Leela Hackett, Amy and the Old Woman, Abigail Burdess, Frederick Lamb and Lord Alvanley, Richard Glasker, Tom Sheridan, Jonathan Dryden Taylor, and Mrs. Porter, Sarah Finnegan. Publish and Be Damned was dramatised for radio and directed by Ellen Dryden, and was a First Rights Radio production for BBC Radio 4.
And it's episode 2 at the same time next week.
Previously on The Now Show!
They announced this week that the search for the new Director General will take place on Saturday night on a glitzy new show. And it's going to be brilliant.
I was born to be the Director General of the BBC.
I've got 25 years' experience in a number of major broadcast infrastructure projects, and for 6 years I was Director of Corporate Affairs in the independent television sector.
I've got a low-cut top on.
So have I.
Returning to the home of radio comedy, The Now Show, Friday nights at 6:30 and Saturdays at 12:30 on BBC Radio 4.